I am Plante on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Early on in Ian Haysom's new book, he says, as a grandfather and all others like him are not their grandfathers, it's not just that people of Haysom's vintage are baby boomers, but the role of grandfather has seemingly been reinvented from one generation to the next, just as music tastes change, say. That's just one of the themes explored in Grandfather, Dispatches from the Trenches of Modern Grandparenthood. The book features pieces written by Mr. Haysom, who joins me now, featuring his four grandchildren and the adventures he's found himself on the last decade or so. He reflects on the difference of being a parent and a grandparent, as well as looks to the future. The pieces in the book are funny as well as poignant, and they're relatable, whether you're a grandparent or not, or someone like me who doesn't have kids and conceivably doesn't see grandchildren in the offing anytime soon. If you're like me and didn't get the chance to meet his grandfathers, the book is also useful, providing a sense of what one might have missed. Ian Haysom is a lifelong journalist who has worked in newspapers, television, and online. He's been a reporter, critic, as well as an editor and columnist, starting his career in Fleet Street in London, then at the Hamilton Spectator, Ottawa Journal, and Ottawa Citizen. He was editor-in-chief of the Vancouver Province and Vancouver Sun. In the world of television, he was the news director at BCTV News, Czech News in Victoria, and Global News here in Vancouver. A couple of the pieces in the book had previously appeared in the Victoria Times columnist, where he has had a regular column for many years. Other grandfathers with pieces in the book include George Garrett, Mike McRaynor, Bob Stahl, and Roger Hope, among others. This new book is published by Heritage House. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Ian Haysom. Mr. Haysom, good morning.
Oh, please, Ian. No one calls me Mr. Haysom anymore.
No one does. Ian, this is a great book. I laughed out loud quite a bit, and I felt sentimental, as one should, thinking about one's life, I guess, growing up. I was too young to have known both of my grandfathers. So,
oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, so I do think I missed something.
Yeah, I think you do. There's something. Actually, somebody sent me a quote the other day. Will children love their grandfathers and grandparents love their children so much? And it says because they have a common enemy. But I think it is something special. It's always been a special relationship, so which I didn't really, before I got into it, I didn't really appreciate. I obviously loved my grandfather to pieces. He was a Yorkshireman, working-class Yorkshireman, almost an Andy cap with a flat cap on and all the rest. And he could do no wrong. And they never, I don't think your grandparents can ever do wrong.
There's a beautiful moment in the book where he grabs your arm. And I was quite moved by that, even though it's a somewhat funny moment. But, I mean, after all these years, it's something that one remembers, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is the small things, you know. I think sometimes we forget the impact we can have on our grandchildren. My grandfather, as I say, was a Yorkshireman, and cricket was big in Yorkshire, still is. It's the county sport. And he took me to cricket matches, and he took me to, and just traveling on a coach bus with him to Headingley, Leeds, from Hull, where he lived, was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. And we didn't do much. We just sat there and talked and smiled and so on, but I thought it was one of my I can still remember it 60 years later, every moment of it.
Yeah. You write early in the book that we are not our grandfather. So the role of grandfather has changed. I guess it gets reinvented generation after generation, but it does seem different from, say, I'm sure his relationship with his grandfather was different than it obviously is with you and your grandkids, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we all redefine to some extent our relationships. I made the point in the book, and the book really came about because I was really a reluctant grandfather at first. I'd worked in media all my life, and as I say in the book, grandpa, or hey, granddad, or whatever, is a bit of a dirty word in media. It means you're past it and so on. But when I got to it, I'm a boomer, and all we baby boomers refuse to grow old. And one of the things that I think is the redefinition is that we are much more engaged than we ever than our grandparents were for us. I played soccer, and my grandfather or my father never came to watch me play soccer, maybe once in a final.
Yeah.
And as a parent, I was there every Saturday. Every Saturday, I coached all my four kids as well. And then I think grandparents now, we're going to live a lot longer, hopefully, touch mm-hmm. wood. But it means that we are much more engaged. Yesterday, my daughter called up and said, hey, we're going to go bike riding. And they're now for lunch. Do you want to come? And it was fantastic. You know, I'm riding with my grandson. The thought of ever riding a bike, or grandson, granddaughter, the thought of ever riding a bike with my grandfather, who was like, well, you know, he was old. He wouldn't ride a bike.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you mentioned your grandfather earlier. You're older than he is.
That's right. Actually, I was shocked, you know. I went to visit my... I'd never been to my grandfather's grave for many, many years. Uh-huh. I was back in England. And I was shocked to see he was just 64 years old when he died. I was 14. And it and I actually did find it shocking because my grandmother lived till 99. Mm. So it was 35 years longer, almost. And so, but he, for me, I always had this sense of him. And I guess our grandchildren, they look at us a different way as well. They think we're old. You know, yeah, I might go skiing with them. I might do all these things that I think are really cool and young and energetic, but they probably think I'm the decrepit old guy who can't keep up.
You also write in the book about the role of grandparents during COVID. In one sense, parents have depended on grandparents, and in another, you know, some have been isolated from them. Do you think this is the pattern going forward? I mean, it has, COVID has changed, hasn't it?
It has. And number one, I think it's helped a lot of people appreciate grandparents a lot
indeed,
more. It
yeah.
was very tough when we were, when we couldn't go to visit our grandchildren my wife and I, first few months of the pandemic, mm-hmm. when it was essentially a lockdown. And you know, we did Skypes and Zooms. We had a family Zoom once a week, which was fantastic, with all our kids and grandkids, and that was marvelous, except grandkids get bored after about 5 seconds looking at you. But then it suddenly went the other way, because, you know, you're suddenly, can we help out? Can we be the, you know, rather than getting random babysitters, can we be there more often, take them out in the afternoon? My wife, I still work in media and television part-time, but my wife is at home full-time now, and she spent a lot of time taking them to beaches and here, there, and everywhere. And so you were leaned on a lot more. And I think we will be leaned on more going forward, but it's very tough, you know, because I still see stories about grandparents who can't see their grandchildren.
Yeah,
and I think that's sort of tough.
Especially if they're far away, and then the travel obviously is a challenge nowadays. The birth of your first grandchild, Mayanna, I guess that is something that one marks their life with, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of, you know, life before and then life after, right?
Yeah, and in fact, with Mayanna, she was born on Salt Spring, still lives on Salt Spring, but. Luckily, her mother comes over quite often. She teaches yoga in Victoria, so I see her a lot. And I've got two grandchildren who live here, and our youngest in Vancouver, North Van.
Uh-huh.
The problem it is a turning point for you. You know, you sort of live in an abstract way. I think as a parent and so on, you do as well. But then when you get, you know, you see this sort of little bundle in your arms, and then you begin to say, oh, wow, this child is part of me and always will be a part of me. And so it's kind of special.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, as I'm reading the book, because I don't have kids and don't plan to, and certainly at this point, I'm 38, seeing grandchildren would probably be impossible at this point.
No. In Victorian days, you would have been a youngster.
Does it change your life? Does it make you a better person, say?
It makes you more reflective. One of the things that, in fact, I wrote a chapter at the beginning. I looked after Mayanna one summer, everyone was doing other things, and I helped look after her, not exclusively, but a lot of the time, 80% of the time. And it made me appreciate, I mean, you talk about smelling the roses. Well, I wrote this chapter about just a walk with my Anna, and you begin to appreciate the stuff that I sometimes think as a parent, you don't really have the time to appreciate, because you're, you know, you're earning a living, you're doing dishes. Nowadays, parents are doing, both parents usually, or single parents are working, and they've got to put food on the table, they've got to pay the rent or the mortgage and everything else. And, you know, they want to give time. I know they sometimes feel guilty about the amount of time they can give them. But as a grandparent, you do become more reflective, and you begin to appreciate the small stuff, because the small stuff is the important stuff in the end. And you get to appreciate, actually, that their love for you and your love for them is unconditional. It is absolutely unconditional, whatever they do. I mean, you always say, you know, what happens at grandma's house stays at grandma's house. Well, there's a bit of that, too. Uh-huh. You know, you spoil them more than you spoiled your own kids. You sort of find that, you know, you just take immense pleasure in being with them. And, you know, that's not to say, I don't want this to sound too sucky, a book, because, I mean, I wanted it to be a funny book as well.
Yeah,
you know, I don't want it to be just some sort of gushing grandfather, you know, fountain of syrup. The idea was it's a book that I hope will make people go, okay. And I hope people, you don't have to be a grandparent to enjoy it, I hope. This just happened to be what I wrote about.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I mean, as I said, I enjoyed it a great deal, even though it's not, I didn't know my grandfathers, and I don't have kids or plan to. So there's a lot of great life lessons in it. The other thing I was wondering about, Ian, was as I was reading it, in terms of advice, giving three of your kids have kids, is that right?
Yes.
So
and three of them have dogs as well.
I see. Yeah.
And grand dogs are an important part. Sorry.
it's a great point to make. Yeah. How are you in terms of giving advice to them about raising their children? Because you have four. Do they ask you? Is it advice that you give readily or unsolicited? Say.
Well, actually, I think for the most part, they'd condemn my advice and start laughing at it. It's a bit like when I play golf with any of my kids or tennis or anything. They say, "Yeah, yeah, Dad, that's just fine. Thanks. Go and sit down now." And I think that's, they'd probably answer differently. They'd say, "Oh, for God's sake, he's always giving us advice." But I try not to. I think it's you try to encourage and be a sounding board. But I know that all of my two daughters and son who have children, they do every now and then ask Beth, my wife, for advice. They don't tend to ask me. I'm not sure why.
What has being a grandparent clarified or changed in your relationship with your own children? I must say, when reading the book, growing up and today, you all seem very close, but I mean, has the addition of grandchildren, has that changed, say, the relationship between father and children?
Yeah, I think it probably has. As I say in the book, we've always had pretty good relationship with our kids. We hang out together now and then and do stuff, and, you know, it's nice. It's, I have a much, I see my kids much more than my parents saw me in later years, you know, when they were grandparents. I think you have a common bond in a grandchild as well, and I think they enjoy watching us enjoy the grandkids as well, and we certainly enjoy. I sometimes find enormous pleasure in just watching one of my daughters interact with her own daughter or son. It's just marvelous. When I see them, when I see my daughter in Vancouver, in Victoria, she has two kids, it's Janny, it's Lyndon and Emma, and I just watch her absolutely just enjoying them and laughing with them. I mean, it really, it's like, it's fantastic. It makes, and it certainly, it helps, you know, it's sort of part of the journey of life, right? You know, we all go through and different stages, and we, you know, we're all players on this Shakespearean stage, and we do what we do. But when you, it's lovely watching, you know, like them doing some of the stuff that I did with my kids. Like, we used to love going camping.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things we all did in the summer, and went here, there, and everywhere, and went and did adventures everywhere. And when I see my grandkids going out on adventures, and, you know, either down a ski hill or you know, going on hikes or biking and so on, then seeing the interaction, that's fantastic.
There are some laugh-out-loud moments in the book. I can't remember the last time I laughed out loud reading something. The story about the ring.
The ring is quite a funny story. I had taken my Anna, who was then three and a half, to the BC Museum. And all the kids love the woolly mammoth. All of our, that's a great thing. If you ever want to show a child something on a rainy day, take them to see the woolly mammoth at the BC Museum,
yeah,
because they spend hours, and there's ice on the side of it, real ice, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. So
anyway, we've gone there, and it was a really nice trip. We on the car on the way home, and my aunt was saying, "Oh, I bought my." I got my mum a present. I said, "Oh, that's nice. What did you get?" She goes, "I got a ring." And I'm, you know, half paying attention, saying, "That's nice." Well, finally I look around, and the ring she had was a skull and crossbones ring. And I went, "Where'd you get that?" And she said, "Oh, in the shop." I said, "What do you mean in the shop?" She said, "Well, it was in a box up there." And I went, "Oh, no." I said, "You sort of just took it?" She said, "Oh, yeah." But, you know, she didn't know anything about shoplifting,
sure,
or anything.
Yeah,
you know,
but
she started young. And so we went back, and I had to explain that you actually had to pay for things. I ended up buying her, I think, if not the ring, I bought, yeah, maybe I did buy the ring and other stuff. But what goes around comes around. When I was a little boy, I stole a little rubber tomahawk, which is inappropriate these days, but it was... I was three at the same time, and my mother made me go on the bus and take it back. So there were life lessons, but, you know, the other life lesson is that I still remember the guy we took it back to wasn't very friendly. He said,
yeah,
"Well, you shouldn't steal." And I was going, "Well, she knows that now." But, you know,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you get very defensive when you're a grandparent.
Indeed, yeah. You wanted to punch the guy out, right?
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to say that out loud, but yeah. But I wrote it out loud, so I guess, yes, I did.
You've written about your kids in the past, but I'm wondering what they think about being written about. And one of your grandkids is old enough now to read, so I'm wondering what does she think about the stories.
Actually,
about her in the
two,
book.
Two of them are old enough.
Oh, okay.
My 7-year-old Emma has been devouring the book and loving
yeah.
it. I made sure, first of all, that and I have written about my kids over the years, the Vancouver Sun column, Province, Times Colonist, and I was going to put some of those columns in, you know, about being a father and a grandfather, but in the end we decided not to. They may go in another time, but I've always made sure that my kids were okay with it. They got used to it after a while, and they've always been okay with it, and when they become teenagers, they're probably less okay for a little while, but then they all seem to be fine.
Yeah.
But my grandchildren love it. My Anna said to me, who's now 10, she said, "So do you get money for this book?" And I said, "Well, I'll get some money." "You don't get any money." She said, "Well, why don't I get any money?" She said, I'm in the book." And I said, "Yeah, but Emma and Lyndon and Summer, our new grandchildren, they're all in there too." She
yeah.
said, "Yeah, but I'm in there most of it." Anyway, I'll work out some royalty disbursement.
You've got to get an agent for the grandkids now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think they've got one.
Yeah,
these guys, their grandmother's a good agent.
Yeah, the what's wonderful is that the stories that you capture about the kids, you know, they're obviously, I don't know if they're, I mean, they probably understand now, but I mean in the future, for them to look back at this. I mean, I'm thinking of the essay in the back of, by Mike McRainer, writing about his grandson. Just wonderful moments with with the both of them that I'm sure that kid will probably delight in reading as he gets older. You know what I mean?
I hope so. And I'm glad you pointed out the what happened. I asked some of my friends, former colleagues, and so on, who I knew were grandparents, if they wanted to write a short piece about it. And they and a few of them have been there, including Mike McCraner, Bob Stahl, George Garrett.
Yeah.
Bob Stahl used to be the columnist at the Province.
Right,
Stahl
yeah.
Stories. Very funny man. But his is a serious one, actually, about Greta Thunberg and saying that he pledges to, you know, our generation needs to work more for against climate change and so on. But he, but George Garrett and Mike have, and others have written really nice, gentle stories about the grandchildren. A funny, a couple of those are funny as well.
Indeed. Yeah.
And that's what I'm happy about the book in the end. It's not a laugh-out-loud book all the time. It's a bit of a mix, but it's... But I hope it, it sort of... It, I hadn't seen a book before that talked about being a grandfather, and I just thought it'd be a fun thing to do, and it's nice to have included some of some other grandparents in there as well.
Yeah, George told me it was he was delighted that you included the anecdotes from his grandkids, because there were a lot of stuff in there that he said that he didn't even know.
Yes. Isn't that good? Isn't
yeah.
that marvelous when you get the grandchildren writing it or the kids writing it?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And but it's... you know, as I said, I don't want it to be too cloying or anything. It's funny, I sometimes think about writing this book, because it's, you know, it's a small book, and it's a, I don't want to pretend it's any more than it is. But I always remember Graham Greene used to write novels, and he used to write entertainments. Brighton Rock was an entertainment, and they were sort of shorter, more accessible books. And I wanted this to be sort of an entertainment rather than a deep read. And it's been nice because lots of people have said they found it as a bit of an antidote to some of the doom and gloom at the moment. So if it's just looked upon as that, I'm pretty happy.
Is writing easy for you?
Yes, I've written... that's I always consider myself a writer. I've been a journalist all my life. I was always a fast writer. I used to write on deadline in England. Nowadays, it's even you know you have to be even faster. But I was always a deadline writer. They would always throw stories to me 10 minutes before deadline because they knew I could get it and write it. And without, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed, in fact, and that's how I write. I'm a procrastinator, and if I have a deadline, I'm fine. And even on this book, I said, "Well, give me a deadline, and I'll hit the deadline." And I did. Wrote most of it the week before. But it's that. But I enjoy writing. But I also remember somebody once saying that, you know, the art of great writing is applying the seat of your pants to the seat of the chair.
Mm.
You know, you've got to get down and do it.
Yeah. And you were right. Even when you were at Global, you would write regularly for the Times Colonist, right?
Yeah, I wrote a Times Colonist column for getting on for 10 years, I think.
Yeah.
But I was a reporter. And many years I was a correspondent for Southern, where I wrote for the Southern papers across the country, which were the Vancouver Sun, Province here, Calgary Herald, Edmonton Journal, Montreal Gazette, Ottawa Citizen, and others. And at that time, we had the Toronto Star as part of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I wrote a lot of pop culture in those days. I interviewed lots of celebs and did those things, you know, movie junkets and so on, and just and loved writing. Fairly lots of Saturday features and so on all kinds of topics, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book telling your kids and grandkids about interviewing Jennifer Lopez at one point, and then you realize that the grandkids certainly didn't know who she was. And then another name that came to mind was Gregory Peck. And I saw Gregory Peck in a movie the other day.
What was the movie? Do you remember?
The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit.
Oh, cool.
It's a long movie, but he's pretty good in it. So what was he like?
Oh, very cool. The thing is, there have been lots and lots of interviews I've done in Los Angeles and New York, because he used to go down as movie critic. So I was a movie critic for many years in Eastern Canada. And he used to go down every couple of weeks, and you'd see a couple of movies, do some junket interviews. And in newspaper days... they'd sit four of you around a little table, and, you know, Dustin Hoffman or whomever, or Gregory Peck in this case, would come up and just chat to you. And Gregory Peck was very, what I liked about him, unless he was a very good actor, is what you see is what you get. Mm. He was in Boys from Brazil, which Laurence Olivier and James Mason were in as well, I think.
Yeah.
And I think I mentioned before, James Mason got offended because I suggested that he may, he tended to play the same part in every movie he was in. He said, no, my boy, I don't know. I'm a much better actor. Anyway,
it's a pretty good James Mason, Ian.
Yeah, but that's a terrible James Mason. But I like the celeb interviews because people like Gregory Peck, as I said, they were just straight up straight people. I remember Richard Dreyfuss; he'd done Goodbye Girl.
Oh yeah,
and that was his very early days. We think of him as old and decrepit now, but God, he was fantastic and young and dynamic. And he was, you know, talked a million miles a second. And there were some just fantastic. Anthony Hopkins, I interviewed him for a lovely little movie called Magic, which if you've never seen, it's worth digging out, with Anne Margaret, where he was a ventriloquist, but he was taken over by the ventriloquist dummy. And it shows you. And, yeah. And I remember my story then. The junket was in Dallas. But I remember my story then that somebody had asked him, because that... Richard Attenborough was the director of Magic,
yeah.
And he was going to be doing Gandhi. And I remember, and Kingsley, Ben Kingsley got the role. And I remember them asking if Anthony Hopkins could be a candidate for Gandhi. And I remember Attenborough, and he was sitting with him. They did the interview together, saying, yes, if he can lose a few hundred pounds.
I guess some people expected a different sort of book from you, and you've shared some anecdotes about a career in as a writer. I'm sure your career in television as well. I mean, you have a million stories. Are you working on another book now?
Yeah, well, actually, at the moment, I'm working on a musical with a friend of mine. I play piano, and he plays guitar. We sing together now and then, and he really wants to do this musical. So he's doing most of the music, and I'm doing most of the words and a bit of the music. But I'm sort of that's going to entertain me for the rest of COVID, I hope, and then hopefully some more books. I'd actually like to write a novel, but I remember once being in a bookstore in Vancouver, Book Warehouse, on Broadway. It's still on Broadway, I think. And I'm talking 20 years ago, and I love books of quotations. Particularly humorous quotations.
Yeah.
I've always loved them. And anyway, I happened to go in Book Warehouse, and there's a big fat book of quotations, and I just flipped it open. And I always thought this was a sign, and there was a quote there, and it said, every journalist has a novel inside them, and that's a good place to keep them. But I still like to do the novel.
Yeah.
I think that's, and sure, I can write. I'm a great fan of, people like Nick Hornby and so on. So I'd like to get a novel out at some point. I wanted to get a book out now, next to novel and musical. At my age, I'm turned 70 now. It's a good time to be doing what I want to do. And that's a lot of fun. I always have. I've loved journalism over the years. But it's sort of nice to go dallying into new levels, not just playing golf all the time.
Yeah, people like Breslin and Pete Hamill, they wrote novels.
That's right.
At the end
absolutely.
Yeah. People wanted other things, but they said no. They'd much rather do that.
And I think in the end, it's what's within you, rather than what people expect. And going back to being grandfather and so on, you do get to be who you want to be a lot more. Not what people want you to be. However much we all want to live life on our own terms, there's always a lot of compromise. Well, if you've got a little bit of money in the bank, so you're not sort of starving when you're in retirement, then you can sort of start to say, well, you know what, I don't need to sit in front of a screen for the next 2 hours. I can go for a walk, I can go for a bike ride, I can go and do something else. And I think that's one of the things that I want to enjoy over the next few years. Not being selfish, but a little bit of selfish, but also trying to not compromise as much. But I also, going back to your thing about being selfless, an obstacle about what you learn about having grandchild, mm-hmm. is one of the things you find you want to do is do things more for others than for yourself. I mean, it gives me immense happiness to, you know, do stuff and help out as much as I can the grandchildren. And that can be on a very small level. The other week we baked some bread together, my mm-hmm. granddaughter and I. I think giving of yourself is probably one of the most valuable things you can do that gives you enjoyment as well.
There's a piece at the near the end of the book where you write about the future. You get reflective, if you will. I found it both melancholy and optimistic at the same time. What future do you expect for your grandchildren?
I really don't know, but there's a couple of things that you know, none of us know. Two things have came to me. One, I've always been something of an optimist, and I always believe that, you know, things will work out because people are mostly good, mm-hmm. and mostly have the best of intentions. And we've been through in history some dreadful moments, not just the wars of the, you know, the last century, but plagues and unbelievable, tortures and attacks and, you know, just indescribable things over the centuries. But, you know, it evolves. You hope that you have to hang on to hope that things will get better. We go through the dark times, but we emerge from them. And the other thing is that I was listening to Cat Stevens the other day, and I've always been a Cat Stevens, Yusuf mm-hmm. Islam, doing an interview in CBC, and he said something really interesting, because he writes, you know, a lot of music that actually has hope to it, mm-hmm. a lot of it.
Yeah.
And he was asked about hope, you know, where did he get his hope from? And he said, you know, part of it is that I haven't grown up. And he said, fully grown up, meaning he still has the wonder of a child. And I think in many ways, I hope many people do, you've got to find your inner child. You've got to find that inner sense of wonder. Because if you get dogged down by, you know, wake up in the morning in despair, then, you know, that despair, I think, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If, however, you look at the world with a degree of optimism and a degree of hope, then I think you can spread that hope. It may be, yeah, it's a bit Pollyanna, but, you know, I prefer Pollyanna to the dark side.
Yeah, and that's what I enjoyed about the book. It lifts one's spirits up a great deal, especially when you talk about how smart your grandkids are as well. Leaves one with a lot of hope about the future. Because a lot of kids
aren't they? Look at children, I mean, you know, high school students today and so on, and climate change. Mm-hmm. You know, we were going to change the world when I was a boomer, right? Mm-hmm. It was, you know, give peace a chance and peace and love and the whole damn thing. Well, we didn't exactly get it right. But, you know, we've raised some pretty good kids, and they're raising their kids well, and let's hope that... we can see some pretty bad things happening. But, you know, then you see the Americans do elect Joe Biden, and, you know, hey, maybe it's all going to be okay.
Indeed. By the way, you mentioned this musical that you're working on with Roger Hope. What sort of music is it?
Well, that's really interesting, because Roger likes to write everything in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I go after him on this. It's like everything sounds a little bit like the Beatles and the Stones and Moody Blues. And I try to pull him more into the musical we're setting is in the 40s, so we argy bargy a bit. He writes fantastic melodies, he really does. So we're sort of trying to make them a little more 40s. But as we said, Les Misérables, which was set in Revolutionary France, wasn't exactly doing French music of the 18th, 17th century.
Yeah.
So I think we can probably get it's a mix of ballads and we hope showstoppers. The working title I won't give you the title, but it's more about it's sacrifice, and it's how people sacrifice down the years. Down to generations, for their children, for their country, for the betterment of the world, and what people are willing to give up. So it's set in the war in the 40s, and between Paris and London, and then but it has but it's still a work in progress, and Roger's doing the heavy lifting and I'm just doing the bits in between.
It's been such a delight to speak to you about this book. I enjoyed it a great deal. Congratulations on it, Ian, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you, Joe. I really appreciate it. And, hey, you know, never say never about grandchildren. Never know. Take care.
Thanks for this.
All the best.
The book is called Grandfather, Dispatches from the Trenches of Modern Grandparenthood. It is published by Heritage House. Its author, Ian Haysom, joined me on the line from Central Saanich in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.